Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this month's podcast, and happy summer. Hopefully you're enjoying this month's edition, soaking up some sun. In this month's podcast, we're going to be doing things just a little bit differently.
Yep, that's right. This month, we're going to be reviewing articles from June and July's JAPA edition as we take a little summer break. But we'll be back to our monthly programming in August.
Yes, and for this month, we'll be reviewing June's CME article on narcolepsy and July's CME article on the preoperative assessment for non-cardiac surgery. And from June's edition, we will be reviewing articles on unconscious bias and how it leads to racial inequities in medicine, as well as creating diversity within the PA programs during the admissions process.
And the last two articles we're going to review, we're really excited about and want to have more room for discussion about these topics. So we're going to be brief, yet still thorough when reviewing our CME articles.
But before we get started, here's our quick disclaimer. This podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition. We share our take and opinions, and they don't represent JAPA, the authors, or the editor's opinions, or the publisher. This is not intended as medical advice.
And remember, everyone, when you read both CME articles, review the post-test, then take the online test at cme.aapa.org, you get a one-category CME if you score at least a 70%. Now on to the CME. Our first CME article is the preoperative assessment of patients undergoing elective non-cardiac surgery by Gail Bodner, Emily Cable, Chris Kaiser, Mackenzie Murphy, and Laura Testad. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. The preoperative assessment helps clinicians identify the risk of perioperative and postoperative complications a patient may experience. This article helps create some guidance on what our preoperative assessment should entail based on our patient's comorbidities and medical history. Patients with a history of coronary artery disease or heart failure, the cardiac preoperative workup is crucial as diseases put patients at higher risk for postoperative complications. For example, patients with recent adverse cardiac events such as an acute MI or unstable angina, these are considered individual risk factors for postoperative CVA. And research shows that for patients with heart failure have a 63% increased risk of mortality postoperatively. Based on the guidelines from the ACC, which is the American College of Cardiology, and the American Heart Association, recommend to consult with cardiology preoperatively for patients with moderate to severe valvular disease, pulmonary hypertension, implanted cardiac devices, or known congenital heart disease. Now, specifically for patients with CAD, there are a few risk stratification tools we can use to help guide us in our preoperative workup and to help discuss these risks with our patients as well. Some of these tools are the RCI, which stands for the Revised Cardiac Risk Index. This evaluates the risk of major complications such as MI, cardiac arrest, and death. However, it uses six predictors to do so, and there are some things to consider when using the RCRI calculator. First of all, this tool does not take into account the type of procedure a patient may be undergoing, and some factors such as hypertension, smoking, age, and sex are not included in the six predictors. However, on the other hand, the American College of Surgeons has developed two other calculators for clinicians to use. The first one is the NESQIP, which is the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program Myocardial Infarction or Cardiac Arrest Calculator, and the NESQIP Surgical Risk Calculator. Both of these do consider the type of procedure the patient is undergoing when calculating risk. Once this has been calculated, you then want to identify how extensive your patient's preoperative workup should be based on the risk. Those at low risk, which is an RCRI score less than 2 or NESQIP score less than 1%, no further cardiac testing is indicated. However, for those at higher risk, we then need to evaluate our patient's overall functional capacity or exercise tolerance for our patient, as these are strong predictors for postoperative complications. If your patient has poor functional status, then a pharmacological stress test is warranted. And if that's positive, revascularization before procedure is strongly recommended. Patients with a history of MI that did not undergo coronary intervention should wait at least 60 days before any surgical procedure. For those who underwent PCI, they should wait at least 30 days, and for those with a drug-eluting stent should wait at least 1 year. And thoughtful consideration should be taken for our patients on DAPT, especially if they're on a P2Y12 inhibitors. These are like Plavix or Brilinta, as these meds may need to be held prior to surgery. For patients with heart failure, a decreased systolic dysfunction leads to an increased risk for adverse events postoperatively, and this increases as systolic function decreases. The highest risk is in patients with an EF less than 35%. And just as a reminder, traditionally ACE inhibitors and ARBs are usually discontinued 24 hours before non-cardiac surgery, and Cochrane review from 2018 revealed perioperative beta blocker use led to an increased risk of stroke and death for non-cardiac surgery. So these meds need to be held in your heart failure patient. For those with pulmonary disease, such as COPD, specifically, they should undergo thorough pre-op evaluation, as COPD patients have longer than average operative times, 4 times longer recovery period, increased post-operative mortality rate, and higher risk of complications such as pneumonia, myocardial infarction, sepsis, respiratory failure, end-stage renal disease, and wound assistance post-operatively. It is recommended to postpone surgery for any patients with an active COPD exacerbation, and consultation and collaboration should occur with anesthesiology for these patients with moderate to severe COPD. For those who are tobacco users, studies have shown that when patients quit 4 to 8 weeks before surgery, this decreases their post-op complications such as ICU admission, impaired wound healing, and pulmonary complications, so cessation should strongly be encouraged during the pre-operative assessment. For patients with obstructive sleep apnea, they should be encouraged to consistently use their BiPAP or CPAP therapy pre- and post-operatively, as well as their hospitalization, to decrease their risk of pulmonary and cardiac complications. Patients with diabetes, the main goal here is to minimize acute hyperglycemia before, during, and after surgery. As we all know, chronic hyperglycemia is associated with increased length of stay and as well with poor wound healing. And the best way to do this is to avoid prolonged fasting and to encourage them to carb load 2 hours before surgery, as this has shown to decrease the hormonal activation that leads to postoperative hyperglycemia as well as postoperative insulin resistance. And additionally, overall, tight control of the hemoglobin A1C is beneficial for your patient, as those with a hemoglobin A1C greater than 7 tend to have increased risk of infection. Patients with hematological disorders, such as anemia, they should be tested for and treated for this preoperatively, as those who undergo perioperative transfusion are at increased risk for sepsis, thromboembolic complications, and poor wound healing. And for patients with clotting disorders, a thorough history should be obtained to assess personal or family history of abnormal bleeding and a thorough review of medications that may increase this risk. Additionally, collaboration with the surgical team is needed to assess if any medications need to be held or if bridging needs to occur. And lastly, for patients with autoimmune disorders or on immunosuppressive medications, they should be encouraged to continue these medications pre- and postoperatively. And beforehand, be sure to assess for any recent or current infections and ask about previous surgical history and any complications or outcomes they've had previously. Brandon, I really wish this was like SP lab we could have done during PA school, because I think it would have been really beneficial to like do a preoperative exam. I know at the hospital I work at, a lot of times, especially when for orthopedic surgery, if we have an elderly patient that comes in for like a hip fracture or something that needs, you know, wrist stratification, you know, we can't do it. But I think it'd be really cool to watch this go down and to know about it, you know, for the outpatient setting. And even to just kind of, it would be cool to shadow like the cardiology side of this and what, you know, how they kind of determine their risk and which kind of calculator and tools they use as well. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, for sure. It's one of those things that we know that like a lot of things are crammed in into our 24 or 27 months. But I wonder if, because, you know, our program was primary care based. I wonder if the programs that are surgical based, maybe this may be a recommendation, not a recommendation, a requirement for them, because they're more likely to come across these situations than someone in a primary care setting. But yeah, I definitely think it's a great it's one of those things that would be beneficial to have, but I know that they're just trying to get us the basics and then get us out into the real world as soon as possible. The next article we will be reviewing is titled Narcolepsy, a Clinical Review. The author, Diana Anderson, has disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. Narcolepsy can be categorized as a chronic neurological disorder that affects the sleep-wake cycle in the brain, with the cycle stemming from the hypothalamus, which is home to the hormones hypocretin and histamine, which activate the neurons that wake you up. An alarming statistic pertaining to narcolepsy is that not only is it a hindrance on the quality of life, but a recent study found that patients with narcolepsy had nearly doubled the health service use costs as patients without narcolepsy. And with the onset of symptoms typically between the ages of 10 and 25, we can see how this leaves these patients at a disadvantage across their lifespan. So what are the different types of narcolepsy? This disorder can be differentiated into two different subtypes. And clinically, the way the subtypes are determined is by the presence of cataplexy. And cataplexy can be defined as a sudden loss of skeletal muscle tone in one or multiple areas of the body without loss of consciousness. In type 1 narcolepsy, there is an absence of about 90% of hypocretin neurons, and the reason for this is still undetermined. This subsequently leads to the inhibition of wakefulness-promoting hormones and reduces the regulation of REM. In type 2, there is no loss of these hormones, and clinically, there is no cataplexy. The most common symptom of narcolepsy is excessive daytime sleepiness, and as stated before, the cataplexy, which is typically preceded by strong emotional triggers such as laughing and crying. Again, this is only present in type 1. And one thing to be aware of is that the patients maintain full consciousness throughout these episodes, which can be important in the history when ruling out other neurological disorders. A major issue with narcolepsy is that many patients have a delayed diagnosis due to mistakenly associating the symptoms of cataplexy with a seizure disorder or a TIA if the face is one of the areas where muscle tone is temporarily lost. It is also noted that in obese patients experiencing daytime sleepiness, they can typically be diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea. Patients with narcolepsy also had complaints of sleep paralysis and hallucinations. And the other symptoms are consistent with the effects of sleep deprivation, such as memory impairment, weight gain, and depression and anxiety. And when psychiatric comorbidities are present, there is an increased difficulty in diagnosing narcolepsy, as it is hard to tell if depression and anxiety are the cause of a person's narcolepsy, or is it a separate pathway causing it. In order to diagnose narcolepsy, patients are to undergo a thorough workup to help eliminate any other contributors to daytime sleepiness. Questionnaires such as the Epworth Sleepiness Scale is a subjective questionnaire that provides insight on the level of daytime sleepiness, and it consists of about 11 questions, and then there's a Swiss Narcolepsy Scale consisting of 5 questions. However, the diagnosis of choice is the Multiple Sleep Latency Test, which is an objective measure of a patient's ability or tendency to fall asleep. And a mean sleep onset latency of 8 minutes or less and 2 or more sleep onset REM episodes is indicative of narcolepsy. Next, the patient should undergo a polysomnogram where there is a continuous monitoring of your brain waves, the oxygen level in your blood, heart rate and breathing, as well as eye and leg movements. It is also imperative that patients discontinue any medications that could affect this type of data for at least 2 weeks before the study. And Lena, any idea on what these medications would be, or any specific medication comes to mind?
I would say beta blockers, as they, you know, decrease heart rate. Some patients report it makes them drowsy or have less energy.
Yep, for sure. Beta blockers are one, as you said, because they cause the drowsiness and suppression of REM, but primarily benzos and opioids due to the side effects of sedation. I had thought about the opioids, but I had forgot. I don't know why I forgot about the benzos, but yeah, benzos and opioids for sure. Due to the fact that there is no known cure, the first step is to establish a good sleep hygiene schedule. This consists of limiting screen times for at least 2 hours before bedtime and incorporating naps anywhere between 20 minutes to 2 hours throughout the day. Eating a well-balanced diet and exercising for at least 20 minutes a day has also shown to improve sleep quality. And there are some medications that are used in the management, such as modafinil, which helps inhibit the reuptake of dopamine. And this happens to be the first-line medication for type 2 narcolepsy. And when the patient has both excessive daytime sleepiness as well as episodes of cataplexy, sodium oxybate is a first-line medication. This medication is a GABA receptor beta agonist reported to have effects of non-adrenergic, dopaminergic, and thalamocortical receptor sites. There is also methylphenidate and amphetamines, which work by limiting dopamine and norepinephrine uptake. And lastly, clinicians should also recommend support groups such as Wake Up Narcolepsy, and another one titled called Project Sleep, which provide resources to patients and their families to address both the emotional and clinical needs of those suffering from narcolepsy.
Interesting. I could definitely see how clinicians can mistake that for sleep apnea, as a lot of the symptoms are the same, or even the questions, you know, how long does it take for you to fall asleep, and, you know, how often, how much do you have daytime drowsiness, and especially if their body habitus is obese, like how you mentioned, I can definitely see that misconception or misdiagnosis. Yeah. Our next article is Unconscious Bias and How Clinicians Can Address Racial Inequities in Medicine by Roxana Benton. Roxana practices in pediatrics at Val Verde Regional Medical Center in Del Rio, Texas. The author has disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. This article discusses how medical inequities continue to persist among patients of color, with majority of the examples in the article pertaining to Black patients and how the negative experiences with the medical system they continue to face reinforce medical distrust among Black patients. Some of the examples they listed are the recent increase in maternal death rates among Black women shortly after childbirth as compared to white women or women of other races, as well as Black patients recently being reported in research supporting this, that they receive less analgesics compared to white patients at significantly disproportionate rates. And of course, social determinants of health that Black patients face, again, at disproportionate rates as well. It also takes a little bit of a dive into the more notorious and historical events that have, again, reinforced the fractured relationship between Black patients and the medical community, such as the Tuskegee experiment. This is one of the more notable and what I would call mainstream examples, I believe, because as the article mentions this, it involves several U.S. health organizations such as the U.S. Public Health Service, the CDC, American Medical Association, and the National Medical Association. If you're a little unfamiliar with the Tuskegee experiment, I would highly encourage you to read the article as it gives a little bit more background about this. But there are a lot of other topics I wanted to talk about this article, so I'm going to let the article talk about the Tuskegee experiment. And the article also mentions some solutions to this, such as offering tools to help clinicians identify their implicit bias, such as the Black-White Implicit Association Test, and to help encourage other colleagues and students to recognize this as well. Which I believe, though this is a start, there are many more steps we need to take beyond this. And as far as my thoughts on the article, I want to back up and talk about some of the other historical events and shed some light on these, as it created the foundation for the poor relationship that, you know, a lot of the Black community and the medical field has had and continues to have today. And this is a topic I'm personally really passionate about, one as a Black woman, but also this is a topic I did my graduate project on. And I remember when I was doing my project and I would like ask preceptors what their thoughts were, and a lot of them were like, I think it's just because there's a lapse of medical education and social determinants of health. And for me, again, I said it earlier, I'm a Black woman, but I don't think people understand that Black people talk to each other when there aren't other people around. And so I know how they feel and what they believe their experiences are and what some of their experiences have been. And so I think this year with COVID and the last year and a half has really brought that to light as well. But as far as some historical events that have happened, in addition to the Tuskegee experiment, which a little bit about Tuskegee experiment, this happened between the late 1920s, started around the 1930s, and continued to about the 1970s, I believe. And there are many events that took much earlier than this, starting in slavery and several afterwards. And one of the, you know, more surprising things is called night doctors. And this happened not just during slavery, but also during the Jim Crow era. And it entailed the kidnapping of slaves or Black people for medical research purposes by, you know, white doctors, and even using them as live cadavers. Also, the mothers of OB-GYN, which is based on Jay Morton, who is known as the father of obstetrics and gynecology. And he's a famous, you know, white male doctor, notorious for studying OB-GYN. However, he studied on enslaved Black women and would perform experimental surgeries on them, and obviously without their consent and without anesthesia as well. And thanks to their contribution, if that's what we could call it. They didn't really have much of a choice, but they are now referred to as the mothers of gynecology. And other well-known examples are Henrietta Lacks and the Bell Curve Study, which is a famous book published in 1994, which essentially stated that Black people inherently have lower IQs. As far as some myths today, there's still the corrected GFR for African Americans, which overestimates GFR in Black patients. And this calculation is based off, a false bias from essentially probably around slavery, that Black people are more muscular and thus naturally have higher serum creatinine as well. And today this affects Black patients, especially those who are on the renal transplant list, since they essentially have an overestimated GFR, and therefore it forces them to wait later before they're eligible for a kidney transplant. Even pulmonary function tests, they're adjusted for Black patients. Again, there's no true actual evidence to support this. It was just based off a calculation and a bias that was created a long time ago. And that there's also the myth that Black people have thicker skin, which is not true, even though this was told to me actually on one of my clinical rotations by a nurse while they were like helping me learn how to practice putting in an IV. Which I know that she didn't mean any harm, but again, this is totally a myth. It's not true at all. And in regards to moving forward, some of my thoughts are, I do agree that, the medical community needs to kind of do a better job of acknowledging implicit bias. But I think more so individual providers, we need to do this. I think we're really good at scapegoating and saying, oh yeah, the medical community as a whole, but we don't look at our individual selves and say, I think I may have an implicit bias. And I think we have no issue with also saying social determinants of health, because again, it's not putting blame or looking at ourselves, we're looking at other factors. But again, Black patients, they're seeing us individual providers. And I just wonder, if the medical community, especially doctors, PAs, it's made up of, and I'll have some stats in a moment that kind of talks about this. It's mostly a lot of white doctors, white PAs, and not many providers of underrepresented backgrounds, such as Black providers, Hispanic providers. And I wonder if there's some indirect guilt, which makes taking accountability a little bit difficult, as well as maybe acknowledging some of the horrible things that, ancestors have done for the sake of privileged medical knowledge and the overall privilege that a lot of people still benefit from today. But also just in general, I feel like as providers, doctors, PAs, MPs, we're all really smart people and we don't like to be told we're wrong. So I wonder, if that also comes into play. But we're in a field that's really crucial to acknowledge and admit our mistakes for our patient's safety and well-being. Another thing, a barrier, I think, to this is the lack of Black providers. And as promised, some quick stats in regard to this. In 2015, the NIH published an article that only 2.4% of PAs in the US are Black and only 3.8% are Hispanic. In 2018, PAEAs, they posted a report that revealed about 24% of Black PA students have delayed graduation, fail out, or drop out of a PA program. And that this has been consistent over the last 30 years as well. And then in 2014, I don't know about the most recent latest data, but in 2014, there were less Black men enrolled in medical school than there were in, wait for it, 1978. So we're kind of going backwards. I won't say backwards, but the numbers aren't, we're not progressing the way we should be. And then also in 2018 from the U.S. World Report, and I believe they got this data from the U.S. Census Bureau, in 2018, there were 150,000 physicians. And out of this 150,000 physicians, only 3,300 were Black men and 1,600 were Black women. So overall, less than 5,000, there's 4,900 of them. And I did the math, were Black. So only 3% of physicians are Black. And so that's really hard when only 12% of the U.S. is Black, but we only have 2% of PAs are Black, 3% of doctors are Black. And so I think there's also true, a lack of familiarity with the culture as well. And, you know, I've also said this before, but I also have the privilege of being a, you know, a Black provider. And so when it comes to seeing and treating Black patients, and because we share the same culture, you know, they're more willing to tell me things that they don't tell other providers and confide in me. I know what specific questions to ask. And even on rotations, you know, if my preceptor was talking to a patient, they'd be looking at me to see what my face is doing for confirmation of what was being said, even though I was only a student at the time. But I would also say at the other, on the other end of things, the lack of having Black providers can also be detrimental, because sometimes I've noticed, and other colleagues have noticed this as well, because there are so few of us, it sets this precedent for some Black patients that a Black provider is inferior. And so sometimes they don't want to be seen by a Black provider, which is just for the sake of the fact that they're a Black provider. And that's not good as well. Some other steps I think we should take is, you know, an actual transparent apology from the medical community as a whole about the disproportionate effect of that, you know, that we've had on the Black community, especially after the pandemic. And we've kind of, I would say, maybe unpack some of these issues, acknowledge some of these issues historically. But with any relationship, any fractured relationship, I think it's hard to forgive, you know, someone that's caused damage if they don't even truly apologize for it. And so I think, you know, acknowledging it is fine and it's great. It's a step, but there could be, you know, obviously further steps as well. I think more interaction and familiarity between the Black community and Black culture among medical professionals. I tend to notice, again, as we previously mentioned, and I think you'll probably hint, you know, your next article, Brandon, will kind of talk about this, but there's a difference in SES between, again, a lot of the medical professionals, what I mentioned, you know, are white providers. We already know Black patients face a lot of social determinants of health, lower socioeconomic status, and I think just naturally, I think sometimes the providers that are seeing, I always wonder, like, do you have any Black people that you socialize outside of your patients? Do you understand Black culture as well? Because I think if when people do, they have a little bit more understanding and empathy as well for their patients, and empathy to take a step forward to understand the culture a little bit better as well. So I think that's important. And if you don't, I think immersing yourself in Black culture, whether it's reading books or even TV, I think a lot of comedy shows kind of talk about the things that we deal with on a day-to-day basis in a, you know, lighthearted way. But I think it's a good way, if you have no way how to understand it, it's a good way, you know, entry point. And I know that, you know, this fractured relationship isn't just between low SES and poor Black patients as well. So that's an also big misconception. But I would like to just say anecdotally, to this date, I think besides you, Brandon, none of my Black friends have been vaccinated for COVID-19. And especially when I talk to my male Black friends, they're more opposed to it. And they all have at least a master's degree, so it's not a matter of them not understanding or lack of education. And it's because they're skeptical and fearful, and they don't trust the medical system at all. And I think they also still feel, you know, they still have difficulty feeling heard as well when they see a provider.
I definitely had a couple friends and associates reach out to me on my to receive some insight on the vaccine and like the effects and like the differences between like Moderna and Johnson & Johnson. So I do think it is important that people have the access to ask someone who they're comfortable with. And that for some people that is someone who looks like them, speaks like them, and we underestimate that impact that can be present in the patient experience of just seeing a familiar face, even in the office. It may not even be that specific provider, but they may have an insight like, okay, like someone in here is like working, maybe like I am safe, like they wouldn't be in here if it wasn't a good environment. Yeah. And there's a lot of stigma, a lot of conspiracy theories. I have a couple friends who are very big conspiracy theorists. Yeah. So I really can't I just choose not to go down that wormhole with them. But, yeah, it's all about just having a familiar face and being able to relate to the people that you're caring for. And if you're not able to relate, if you haven't, I know there's a couple classmates in like PA school that had, weren't really familiar, hadn't really been around Black people prior to, PA school. And especially when I went to undergrad, there were a couple people that were like, yeah, you're my first, like maybe my second or third Black classmate ever. So you can't expect people to know how to interact in these situations, yeah, that they've never been in before. And they never had to take into account the feelings, the past trauma of someone who doesn't look like them or hasn't had the same experience in America as them.
Yeah. And it's frustrating for me, at least, when I like see the gap. Like, I can understand where both parties are coming from or we're trying to convey, and it's just not working. And so I'm wondering if we could like practice on rendering this even outside a medical setting, because I mean, in general, a medical setting's not a good setting to render anything. I mean, everyone doesn't like, no one likes to go to the doctor or see their provider or PA or anything like that. But I think it also starts outside of the actual field of medicine, yeah, as well.
For sure. So my article, I guess, kind of piggybacks off of what yours was, or is definitely related to it. It was titled "Diversity Requires an Admission Process Overhaul," and the author Harrison Reed has disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. And this article highlighted how the PA profession is a microcosm of our nation, noting the aspect of there being an underrepresentation of ethnic and racial diversity. It is noted that the number of Black PAs now hovers over 3%, while a few years ago the number was about 9%. And this reminded me of the statistic that you had stated earlier, that was associated with the med school applicants, in the sense that in 2014, there were fewer Black men in med school than there were in 1978. And despite the number of PA schools nearly doubling over the past 20 years, the number of students is between 3% and 4% of people of color. A good point that was made in the article was that there is no specific delivered conspiracy to the demographics of the PA profession. However, as this country is inherently racist, it is not surprising that these biases have made their way into the application process. And I thought that was a major something very important that needed to be said, because it's rarely ever going to be this overt, just blatantly in your face type of discrimination. It can just be like habits, thought processes, our biases. I know we took a one class that I remember a professor was telling me, like, always just check your biases before you go into a room with the patient. And that's important, being aware that we do have these biases, but just as long as we acknowledge that they are biases, and you need to go into each patient room, each situation with a clear mind, is definitely important, and making sure that you treat everybody fairly and equally. And then just was thinking about, of ways of how to make the process a more level playing field, with the sense that we know how expensive the interview process is, the traveling costs, everything adds up, and not everyone has that support system to properly fund and apply to all these schools to help increase their chances of getting in. And I had come across this idea. I think one of my friends mentioned it, or someone else mentioned it, but was just the idea of having virtual interviews, which helps to alleviate the financial burden of the travel process. And as the pandemic has proven, a lot can be accomplished over Zoom and Google Meet. So there's no reason why we can't start incorporating those things into the admission processes, and not having everyone have to come to campus just for 45 minutes. I know some people have to travel like hours just for maybe 30, 40 minutes of their time, which is a And I think about the, like, again, just the cost of the application cycle, and I thank God for my mother, the support that I had, that got me through it, because the jobs are jobs that require us to get our patient care hours. What is it making anything? Making $15 an hour at the max. Yeah. I know some people that were getting paid less than that as, like, scribes and EMTs. And then if you have someone who isn't able to live at home or doesn't have a family to support, that money goes to your rent and gas. And then you don't have any excess money to apply for as many schools as possible. And I know that I mentioned in the article that we know that the amount of schools that you apply to increases your chances of getting into PA school. So someone who comes from a privileged background who can apply to 20, 30 schools, they have the likelihood to get in on their first try. And also there were multiple people, I remember on my, when I was going on my, I guess, interview tour, that I was surprised that people were like, oh, this is my third, fourth time applying. And I was like, man, kudos to you. I don't think I could go through this cycle again. Yeah, or definitely afford that, or just like the mental burden of it. But it shows that they have like the support to go back and try again and just continue chasing their dreams. And I know there are some people who were like, hey, if I don't get in this first cycle, then I have to find another career. Like, I can't afford going through this again. And the article also touched on family ties and connections in the world, where there are very, very few minorities. And it's rare that you know people in these positions, in hospitals or health systems, that can get you like shadowing opportunities or connections with people in like PA programs to help you get some insight on the career, or even get your foot into the door. I know I didn't know anybody in the PA field. I knew a couple people in the medical field just because of my undergrad. I was very privileged. The high school I went to had friend whose dad was a MD who had introduced me to the career. But I know not everyone has that opportunity. It's really rare that you know people who can advocate for you, who can point you in the proper direction of this. So it's a very tough place to be in right now, and hopefully there'll be solutions on how to make it a even playing field for people coming from not so privileged backgrounds. And just wondering, how did you get your shadowing experiences?
I finesse, because I grew up in a very rural country area, which would be great for PA, more PAs. I mean, I know we have pockets of them now, but I remember in high school we had and we're both, just to give background for, you know, both of Brandon and I were both Black PAs, both from like single parent like households as well. Like, but I like my like sophomore year in high school, we had to like take, we had like 9 different permanent substitute teachers for chemistry, which again, that's also another, you know, thing that can, you know, that's a big setup, because I ended up having to take like remedial chemistry in college because I didn't learn any chemistry. But I remember one of our substitute teachers, she actually was a PA student that was like getting ready to take her pants, and I remember a couple years later I worked at Claire's in high school, and she was like buying something for her daughter. I was like, are you still a PA? And she was like, yeah. Or like, are you a PA now? And she's like, yes. And she literally gave me her email on like a receipt paper when I was like ringing her up. And she's like, when you get to that point, email me. And so like, I kept her email and she let me shadow her. But that also, like, you just have to be on your game and pay attention. But
yeah, that you was have lucky. To
but
wait
if I
for...
didn't have that one chance, yeah. I wouldn't, you know, have much to go off of. And even to think about, once I was in PA school, the cost of it, like, I didn't have a car until rotations. Like, I got a car for rotations to, like, get around, and that was, like, you know, a struggle and a half. Or you think about, you know, a lot of people put things on their loans. They're like, well, just get a loan. Well, if you don't have credit, and you're like, well, use your parents. Well, if you come from a single parent household, you know, that parent may not also have the best credit. And then it's like, well, where do you get the money to support, mm-hmm. you know, yourself as well?
Yeah.
But I think we should, you know, the article was good at least acknowledging the fact that these things happen. But I also want to echo that marginalized students and Black students, like, this, we already know this, you know. I mean, it's great to maybe shed this light onto some of those people who don't know this. But I think also moving forward, now that we've established it, is to focus on efforts on how we can do better, you know, like instead of, you know, I think the article mentioned, you know, people, you do mission trips instead of mission trips, like, okay, life experiences, that is just as equivalent, you know, like, you can't serve a disadvantaged background if you're coming, if you are part of the disadvantaged background to an extent. So, you know, like, you can't serve from an empty cup. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, also considering that as points as well when doing interviews, I think that would be beneficial for students from underprivileged backgrounds as well. And I think also, oh no, go ahead.
Oh, I was thinking that, yeah, it is very, this is something that isn't new to us, but it always, like, surprises me, especially, like, with everything that's going on in this world over the past few years, that mm-hmm. the level of just ignorance that people have, that they truly just don't know, like, they live in a bubble, they think that mm-hmm. everything goes the way,
that they experience.
Yeah, that they experience. So I do appreciate the article for highlighting these things, because hopefully someone who doesn't know, who has been in their bubble this whole time, is able to start opening their wings and understanding that, because there's a bunch of people who have several different experiences coming from this country, and it's not just, I guess, this experience that's highlighted as the American dream, where everything goes nice, you have the white yeah. picket fence and the green lawn. Like, that's not the experience for everybody. So the more people become educated, I think the more often people become aware of these things, the more likely they are to want to be educated on these things and to make the change and yeah. to contribute to the change.
Yeah. And I think also to decreasing the diversity and there, but retaining, you know, diversity within a PA program, like how, you know, mentioning earlier, you know, people, students from underrepresented backgrounds, they have higher rates of dropout and having to repeat a year, which that is also a financial strain in itself. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think even in our experience, like we had a good number of like diverse students and particularly Black students, but only what, 4 of us graduated that started mm-hmm. with us. So, and that's again, like we mentioned before, like, that's less Black, those less Black providers to care for Black patients or Hispanic patients or Native, you know, American Indian patients that, you know, understand, would rather have someone that, you know, or thrive sometimes better with a provider that is from the same culture as them. Mm-hmm. So it's a cycle that's feeding itself, unfortunately. Yeah. But that's how systemic
racism is. Works. Yeah. Yep. Well, everyone, I hope you enjoyed this episode with Lena and myself. We look forward to the articles for August.
And please be sure that you're following JAAPA on social media. Their Instagram handle is at JAAPA online. And under the June or July issue posts, let us know your thoughts about the topics we went over today. We'd love to hear your input.
See you soon.
Bye.